No, it's hard to hear you.
This is Nicole Martineau in the Vancouver region.
Hi, Nicole. How are you? How's
Hi.
The weather up there in Vancouver?
It's beautiful, actually, today.
Oh, good.
And this is Gail Eastwood down in Redway.
Who down in Redway?
Gail.
Gail. Hi, Gail. How are you?
Good. How about yourself?
Yeah. I'm doing fine, thanks. Who else is on? Who'd like to say hi?
Hi, I'm Judith from Toronto.
Hi, Judith.
How are you?
Good. Still early, so we're going to take a little bit of time here. But feel free to say hello for anybody who's joined us.
The eager beavers tuning in early.
Can't wait.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was late, actually. Isn't it 5 past?
It looks like
so
it's just about 9 o'clock now.
I think.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, I never really know if the computer's actually synchronized to the right time.
Are you on the phone, Allison?
Yep.
Okay, great. So anybody else who's joined us like to say hello?
Hi, this is Joan from Virginia.
Hi, Joan. How are you doing?
Just great, thank you.
Good.
Should we be on the computer at the same time?
I don't think it's necessary. Ian, have you joined us yet? Okay, he's going to call right in on the hour.
Yeah, what
anybody
time
else who'd like
with?
To say hello?
Hi, this is Lori from Hollywood, Florida.
Hi, Lori. How are you?
I'm great.
Good.
And Mary Terhune from Boston, Mass.
Oh, hey, Mary. How's it going?
Great, thanks.
Good.
Kim, can I ask one question?
Sure, Kim.
Can we not use speakerphone with this? Is it better not to? Or
no, it doesn't really matter because I'll be muting everyone out during the course of the formal part of the interview.
So we can use speakerphone?
You can use whatever you'd like. It's no problem.
Great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Sure. Anyone else on who'd like to say hi?
Hi, this is Mary Beth from Jackson, Wyoming.
Hi, Mary Beth. How's it up there in Wyoming today?
Hello.
Hello. Is that Ian?
This is Ian. Hi.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, great.
Welcome.
So we've got a number of people who've joined us for the call, and I'm going to go ahead and mute everyone out, and then we'll conduct this interview the way we normally do, which is I'll do a 45-minute formal interview, and then I'll unmute the lines, and then people who have joined us for the call can ask their own questions at that time. So let me go ahead and unmute the other people. Ian, can you still hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Great. Okay, well, first of all, thank you so much for taking the time out of your very full schedule to join us for this interview. We greatly appreciate it. Let me just give you a quick introduction, Ian. Ian Watson is the co-founder of the Lakeland College, which was established in 1993 and is known internationally as a lecturer and workshop leader in the fields of homeopathy and also self-development. His homeopathic training is very broad-ranging and includes both classical and non-classical approaches. And his practice embraces the use of things like herbal tinctures and flower essences and energy body work alongside with homeopathy. So I think this is very interesting for those of us who are interested to see how these different modalities can actually be integrated together. I think this will be a very informative call. He's also the author of A Guide to the Methodologies of Homeopathy, Musculoskeletal Problems, and also another book called The Tao of Homeopathy, which is not so much about doing homeopathy, but really draws attention to that place within ourselves from where we can approach our homeopathic work. Ian likes to call this the inner game of homeopathy. He's recently retired from homeopathic clinical work and from the Lakeland College to develop his knowledge and experience in the field of personal transformation. So Ian is draws from many different approaches, has a very strong background in classical homeopathy as well, and we're very excited to have you join us on the call. So thank you so much, Ian, for taking the time out of your schedule to participate with us.
My pleasure.
Okay. Well, let me go ahead and just get started. Actually, before I do that, I know that Allison Burden is on the line, and I know that for those of people who might be interested in acquiring your books, or I know you have an excellent set of CDs, I know that Allison was going to mention about some discounts available on those.
Yes, and I'm very excited to have Ian join us today. I first became aware of Ian when his revised Guide to the Methodologies came out in 1999. It's an excellent reference book. I would encourage everybody to lay their hands on a copy. And to show our appreciation to all our book lovers and people collecting audio CDs for their collection, today we're going to offer a special for people who order Ian's materials. If you order one of the Ian's publications or CDs, we will take 10% off your entire order. If you order two, we'll make it 15%. And if there's three of Ian's works on your order, we'll take 20% off. Also, consider the Tao of Homeopathy as a gift. It's a beautiful little book for anybody who has to buy for that hard to shop for homeopath on their list. You can place your orders online at wholehealthnow.com/books, or you can always call me Monday to Friday Pacific time at 866-599-5950. So thanks again, Ian. It's a thrill to have you with us today.
Thanks, Allison.
Thank you, Allison. Really, it's through Allison that we even became aware of Ian's work, because she was such a big fan for so many years. Well, again, Ian, thank you so much for joining us. I thought I would start by just asking you, since the topic of the call here is the healing relationship, I'm curious. A lot of people think that homeopathy's role is simply to take the case and gather the data while you're taking the case, and that's going to lead to the remedy. Is this how you feel that it works, or do you have any comments on that idea?
Well, yeah, absolutely, that's how it works. That's what homeopaths have always done and will continue to do, and it serves us very well much of the time, except when it doesn't. And I'm not interested in taking away from what homeopaths do well, but I've always been interested in looking at the areas where homeopaths could add to what they already do well by drawing from other fields, expanding the options available to us, you might say, so that when the standard approach isn't entirely satisfactory, or we're struggling with a case, or there's something in the dynamic between myself and that client that I'm working with which seems to be making progress difficult, then this is a time when I think it's worth taking a different approach to the case taking. And having done that in certain types of cases, what I found was that actually this had benefits in any kind of case, even when you're doing a fairly standardized, run-of-the-mill case-taking situation. It can be transformed by approaching it from what you might say is a different place within yourself. Just to elaborate on that a little bit, there's two underlying assumptions behind this idea that the homeopath's job is to basically take the information and find the remedy. The first is that it's the remedy which is a crucial factor in the person's healing, which it may or may not be. Oftentimes it is, but I've had numerous patients I've worked with over a period of time, only to discover from them subsequently that, in fact, the remedy was a secondary factor as far as they were concerned, and that there was something about the interview, you might say, the relationship that was built up, the kind of questioning approach that I'd adopted that was helpful in and of itself. So this is something that I learned from my clients, was that they were getting more value out of the case taking than I'd previously given credit for. The second assumption I think we need to be aware of is that the idea is when everything is focused on the remedy, by necessity, the practitioner becomes the expert and the client becomes relatively passive, you might say. I mean, yes, they're giving us the information we need, and there's an interaction going on, but ultimately it's down to us to figure out what they're going to need and what they'll need subsequently, and we make an assessment as to how well they're doing based on what they tell us and so on and so forth. And I think that this can create problems in the longer term of treatment. One is that, it's simply put, there's a lot of pressure can build on the homeopath to get it right. And this I know from the training work that I've done, is that many of us go through a lot of anxiety about finding the right remedy. One of the things I've learned is that the least effective way to proceed as a practitioner, I mean, as in life, is to be in a state of anxiety. If you're worried about getting it right, if you're putting that kind of pressure, like a pressure to perform on yourself, then it actually reduces the chances of succeeding. The other thing is that this dynamic that we set up, whereby we're the expert, we're the one that's doing the work to find the remedy to bring about the healing, it tends to create a kind of dependency mode between the client and ourselves. And my own feeling is that as people really start to heal, one of the essential components of that healing process is that they become increasingly independent of the practitioner. We should be looking for a growing self-reliance on their part, not an ongoing state of dependence. So these are things, areas that have concerned me, and these are some of the reasons, you might say, why I've explored case-taking from other perspectives rather than just a simple mode of gathering data, finding remedies.
Ian, you know, this healing relationship seems to be something that's very important in the work that you're doing. What are the prerequisites for cultivating a healing relationship with our clients?
I think in order to answer that, I'll just preface it a little bit with a general statement, which is that we should be aware that the practitioner role certainly has the possibility, at least, of being multifaceted these days, serving a number of different functions, which go way beyond the traditional role of the homeopath, if we can call it that, of helping a person to get relief from their suffering, whatever that might be. Yes, that is one of our functions, but certainly in the UK, I don't suppose it's that different in the US, homeopaths increasingly become a substitute for what would have been the family GP or doctor. They become a kind of caretaker for the well-being sometimes of a whole family. Sometimes we're required to be a wise counsel, a sounding board for that person to clarify things in their life. We're also educators. We know we're teaching our clients about susceptibility and problems that can happen from vaccination and drugs and medication and so on and so forth. We're also a referral station sometimes, helping people to take the next step beyond homeopathy or instead of homeopathy, where perhaps they need some body work or psychotherapeutic help or something of this kind. So I think that once you broaden out the role of homeopath, then the requirements of the role also are increased. Now, the idea that the relationship in and of itself could be healing is certainly not a new idea. I don't know whether Hahnemann thought that way, but certainly probably the best homeopaths that I've worked with, when I've sat in with them in clinic, I've certainly noticed that there was something in and of the session itself that was healing or had the potential to be. So I think the first prerequisite for cultivating healing relationships, having studied this a bit, is simply a recognition that this is a special thing here. This relationship is not like an ordinary friendship relationship or family relationship. It is a sacred relationship, in my opinion, and it has different parameters, rules, expectations, which should be respected, such as there should be clear boundaries, for example. This is certainly something that most homeopaths learn by bitter experience, if they don't do it consciously, is that we have to set up clear time and space boundaries and stick to them. We have to have clear boundaries around money, charging, ethical boundaries, etc. These are important in any profession where there's some kind of relationship where one person is by its very nature is in a more powerful position than the other. We have to put some things in place, not just for the protection of the client and the practitioner, but also to enhance what happens within that space. And there should also be clear agreements, I think. What does the client want? Many people come in with an idea of what they want, but by the time they're half an hour into the interview, it's completely gone out the window. It's been replaced with something else. What is it that as a practitioner are offering? Is there a match between those two things? Sometimes there is and sometimes there isn't. What kind of time frame are we operating on? And are we putting a reasonable time frame in place so that we're not feeling this pressure to get it right within a month's time? If it's going to be likely to be a difficult case, what's it going to cost the client? These kind of clear agreements, I think, really are a prerequisite. And another thing which I think certainly my own training was neglected, and it's something I had to learn on the job, was to build in a kind of commitment on the part of the practitioner to your own self-healing journey, if we can call it that. In other words, a willingness to take responsibility for your own issues, which will colour your practice work and influence it for better or worse. Those are the things that come to mind.
Very interesting, Ian. I know that you've done a lot of work in other areas outside of homeopathy, other disciplines, and I was curious if you could maybe help us to understand what homeopaths could learn from other disciplines about healing relationships in general.
A lot. I think that, I mean, the healing arts generally, and specifically in the fields of energy healing, emotional, psychological healing, these fields have all undergone radical transformations in the last few decades. I think homeopaths could certainly embrace some of the skills from the field of what you could broadly call interpersonal skills, drawing from things that have been learned in the fields of counseling, for example, transactional analysis, psychology and psychotherapy. It's not to say we need to become psychotherapists in order to be homeopaths, no, but we could learn what some of the best practices are, that some of the things that they've discovered can enhance healing relationships. Give a few examples. If you look at Jungian psychology, for example, this idea of projection, I think, is a crucial one for any kind of practitioner-client work, and understanding that we all have blind spots, what Jung called a shadow, where we're actually unable to see certain aspects of our own nature other than when it's projected onto another person. In other words, we see it reflected back in another human being. We don't see it in ourselves. If there's no awareness brought to that aspect of oneself, then we will inevitably project things onto our clients as they will project things onto us, which means that we're not actually treating them as they are. We're treating our own idea of how they are. I call it prescribing on our own fantasies, and I've done it many times. Homeopathy is very forgiving, fortunately. We usually get away with it one way or the other, but it's not necessarily best practice. In the world of transactional analysis, the great quote from Eric Byrne, I think it was, "I'm okay, you're okay," establishing a basic equality in the relationship, a sense of mutual respect and equality, which seeks to break down that kind of false, almost hierarchical mode that we automatically go into when we visit a practitioner. Somehow they are the expert. We do put them on a pedestal. And yet, once that's happened, the relationship is now skewed in a particular way. I know in the TA world, they have things like client contracts, where it's agreed ahead of time, before the treatment begins, what is it that's been aimed for? What are the expectations here of the client? How will they know when those expectations have been fulfilled? And just taking the trouble to really tease these things out at the beginning of a piece of work with the client, I found can be really, really helpful. Other things I've learned, for example, in the counseling world, there's a fancy phrase called self-disclosure, which is exactly what it's described as. In other words, if I feel like I'm struggling with a case, rather than go into the expert mode and pretend that I'm doing okay, I might say to the person, you know what, I'm really struggling. I don't know how you feel about this, but I'm starting to feel a little bit out of my depth here. Or, you know, I've never worked with this kind of problem before, so if you're willing, I'm going to ask you to bear with me while I get familiar with the disease or with the problem that's at hand. This kind of thing, I mean, it's simple little things, but these are things that I've learned from working with practitioners in other disciplines, and they've really helped me a lot. In the person-centered approach, the Rogerian counseling, the emphasis there is all on encouraging clients to find their own solutions, which it's known will frequently happen if the environment is supportive and encouraging. And so I brought some of that into my homeopathic work. In other words, taking the focus off myself as being the one that goes to the repertory and finds the remedy, it's often the case that I've actually engaged with the client to the extent that they've literally found their own remedy. Not always a homeopathic remedy, I have to say, but frequently it has been. Also, I've learned from people like R.D. Lang, who's a Scottish psychiatrist. He's dead now, but he really broadened the view of what was possible in psychiatry. he had a lovely phrase. He says, the treatment is how you treat someone. And I really tried to take that on board, meaning really bring some awareness to how do you conduct yourself in the interview. Are you in a kind of robotic mode asking a list of questions? Well, yeah, I was as a beginner homeopath. That's what I used to do. I had the standard questions that I asked everybody. And then I learned that when I go into that mode, what goes out the window really is the kind of human interaction, the real connectedness with that other human being is missing when you're in a kind of data gathering mode of operation. So these are things that I've just picked up almost kind of magpie-like from various fields. You can learn a lot just by reading from different disciplines, but also working alongside practitioners who are skilled in other fields I've found really invaluable, as well as doing bits of training here and there to try and fill in some of the gaps that I noticed in my own homeopathic training. And I think one of the other fields that I learned a lot from is the general field of energy healing. And sometime in my own practice work, it just struck me like a lightning bolt that as a homeopath, I'd been talking about the vital force for years. I'd presumably been working with this invisible, nebulous thing called vital force for years, using energy medicines, which have got virtually nothing material in them. But I didn't have an experiential knowledge of what that was about. It was theoretical. And it was only a personal experience of actually going to an acupuncturist one time who was very skilled and receiving an energy diagnosis that really opened my eyes to what that was about. I sat in a room with someone who didn't know me, who didn't ask any questions, who simply put her hand on my wrist and felt my pulses and told me what the problem was with unerring accuracy. And that was wonderful for me because I realized I couldn't do that as a homeopath. You know, I was reliant on the report and the questioning and so forth. And that really sent me scurrying around to find ways of understanding how the energy body communicates its disturbance, other than just looking at a kind of list of symptoms in a rather two-dimensional way. I started getting interested then in, well, what are these energy centers that the Vedic tradition talks about, the chakras? What are these meridians that the Chinese medicine practitioners talk about? And so forth. And I began to assemble my own map, you might say, of the energy system, so that even if the person couldn't articulate what was going on, I could still get a clear sense of what was going on according to my own point of reference. And I think this is an area that is severely lacking in standard homeopathic training, is that we learn how to take down symptoms. We don't necessarily learn how to diagnose energy.
Very interesting. You know, Ian, I think that this is a very fascinating subject, you know, how we can use, you know, new developments in psychology and Jungian therapy and the work of Carl Rogers. You mentioned R.D. Lang. And then you also mentioned energy work as being something that can be integrated with homeopathy as well. You know, this might seem a little daunting to some of our listeners in that these are huge, vast fields. You know, Jung wrote, I don't know, close to 100 titles, and, you know, these are prolific writers. Is there a place where somebody could go and get some just really gems from these different ideas? I mean, where would somebody go? And because it would be hard for them to go and just study Jungian psychology or study the work of Carl Rogers. And so is there some suggestions that you could make on a practical level in terms of where they could get more information that they could use to integrate with their practice of homeopathy?
Sure. I mean, it's all in my books.
Oh, okay.
No. No.
Well, that was the perfect question then.
I think that for me, the most important thing is not to suddenly try to encompass all of these different fields, because as you rightly point out, they are huge. Yeah. Jungian psychology alone is a lifetime study.
Sure.
So that's not what I'm suggesting. But what's always worked for me and seems to work for people that I've seen adopt the same path is to follow your own interest with a passion and to find out which fields you're drawn to and to stick with those. I happen to be a little bit magpie-like in my approach. You know, I'm interested in many things and I've drawn from many different disciplines. But 20 years ago, I couldn't read Jung. I tried because I knew there was something of there in value, but I couldn't get close to it. And so I put it away. And then eventually I came back to it and thought, well, now I can read half of it. And I can understand maybe 20%. But there are other people, like, for example, Robert Johnson in the U.S. is a fantastic writer and a conveyor of Jungian ideas. Marion Woodman is another. These are people who have worked with in that field for many years, and then through their own experience, they're able to relate it in a much more user-friendly way. It's often the case that the original source is not the easiest one to get to grips with the ideas. People say that about Hahnemann as well, I think.
Sure.
So,
but in your CDs, though, you cover a lot of these different things and how to use them.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
This has always been a kind of theme of most of my seminars, and continues to be, really, is relating my own experience of what I've found useful from different fields and passing that on in the hope that it might be interesting to other people. People who listen to my seminars and workshops over the years have often commented that there's a kind of development that they can observe in that, because it's reflecting my own interests at the time, and as they've grown and moved on, then the material that I'm working with has also changed. But I always emphasize that people don't just go out and read the books that I'm necessarily interested in. It's like, find the ones that you're interested in. I know I've got homeopathic friends who stick very closely to the traditional way of working with homeopathy, and that's actually what they should be doing, because that is their passion. My passion has been looking at what these other disciplines can offer and finding ways to integrate that. So I think the important starting point is to check in with yourself and say, well, what in my own practice am I not satisfied with? Where do I come unstuck? This is basically was the motivation for me, was to take a look at my practice over a period of years and say, well, where am I struggling? What cases do I find difficult, or what kinds of scenarios do I find difficult to work with? And then I literally just went out scouting around to try and find something or someone that could help me fill the gap. So that's really what I recommend to people.
Very, very good advice. So, a lot of the listeners, a lot of the people on the call probably have heard of this idea of the unprejudiced observer. It's
yes.
Tenets in homeopathy. And I was curious, how does that relate to what we've been talking about so far, the ideal of the unprejudiced observer?
Yeah, this is an interesting topic, which is it's always featured in the training work that I've done with students and new practitioners. We are all taught, I think, pretty much, that this is one of the ideals that we should aspire to as practitioners. At least I was, and most of the people that I seem to work with still are taught that at homeopathy college or through the reading. There's a problem that I came across some years ago was, first of all, noticing that it was, in fact, impossible ideal.
Sure.
it doesn't seem to hold up in practice. Which of us is unprejudiced? Without prejudice means that you're not prejudging anyone about anything. And, of course, one does all the time. The person walks through the door and they look at you a certain way, boom, you're immediately making some kind of assumption about who they are, where they're coming from, etc. So the first realization for me was prejudice happens. It's there. We need to somehow accept that and not pretend that it's not there. The other thing is, the bit of that is the idea of observer. And when I started looking into what is still called the new physics, this was one of my interests some years ago.
You're talking about quantum physics.
Yeah, which is no longer new, of course. I mean, this was since the 1920s. These ideas have been known and well established in the field of physics. What these guys realized over 80 years ago is that there is no such thing as an observer in the sense of someone who is objective to a phenomena that's being witnessed. The one who observes also participates, and by participating you influence the outcome whether you're aware of it or not. And when I really encountered that idea in the world of physics, something in me said, yes, of course. That is not only true at the subatomic level, that's true on the human level too.
Sure.
We do not just observe. If someone walks into the room and sits down in your space, you are influencing each other even before you start to verbally communicate. You're making internal adjustments in response to what you perceive that person to be and et cetera, et cetera, and it's a two-way dance. So this really shattered for me the notion that, that the unprejudiced observer was something, a kind of worthwhile pursuit. So I threw it out and looked for something that would was a more workable solution. And I, what works for me is to adopt the stance of being a, I call it a self-aware participant, where you strive to become aware of your prejudice. You know, what are the things that are coming in that influence the way that you see somebody, the way you work with them? Just bring some awareness to that internal process and participate in the therapeutic interaction consciously and fully. Don't pretend that you're kind of just a witness, a sort of neutral blank space, you know, who's not been affected by what's been said there. Why not participate in it and engage in it and acknowledge that this is what's happening? I found that a much more comfortable mode to operate in, so that we recognize that there is this dynamic interaction going on, which is then it becomes possible also that it can be beneficial for both parties. I've found that it can be hugely healing for me to engage in that process with a client, just as it might be for them. Whereas when you're in the mode of kind of trying to be this detached observer, the assumption is always that, you know, this client is the one that needs fixing, and I'm somehow okay, and I don't like that. It doesn't sit comfortable with me anymore.
Ian, did you see What the Bleep Do We Know?
What, sorry?
What the Bleep Do We Know?
No.
Oh, you should go see that movie. It's about quantum physics, actually, and it's
I'd love that.
Fabulous, incredible.
We only
anybody
get the movies.
If you haven't seen it, you should see it. It really touches right on homeopathy too. Yeah.
What's it called again?
It's called What the Bleep Do We Know.
What the Bleep Do We
Know?
Yeah,
it's a big hit here in America. Very.
We might get it in a year's time or something if we look.
Yeah, I understand.
But I'll look out for it. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. You'll love it. So I'm curious. This is something that there's a lot of different opinions on here in North America about whether we should tell the clients the remedy that we're giving to them or not. And I'm just curious what your feeling was on this particular issue.
Well, I've really come around to thinking that, of course, the client has every right to know. I mean, in England, I don't know how it is in the U.S., the client has a legal right to know what treatment they've been given, no matter what the discipline. So it's actually illegal for homeopaths to withhold that information against the client's wish. There's a very different thing between the client saying, making a conscious decision, saying, you know what, I'd rather just take the treatment and tell me afterwards, because, you know, especially if it's a homeopathically minded client, in other words, they know a little bit, they're a student or the practitioner, they may be, from their own volition, they may say, you know, I'd rather not know. I'd rather just go along with the treatment and you tell me afterwards, because I don't want to go and look in the book and influence the outcome and so forth. That's one thing. I think it's very different when the practitioner coerces the client to essentially not know, or we insist that they not be told, or we tell them that it's in their interests. This is us going into the parent mode, I think, and it's ultimately disempowering for our clients. What are we afraid of here? The idea that people will somehow misuse this knowledge, that they can't be trusted with it, or that it's going to be somehow damaging to their healing process. I think it gives out an unhelpful, unconscious message, even though we've got frequently homeopaths will come up with good reasons, you know, they say, well, it's, you know, it's better that they don't know and blah, blah, blah. But I think unconsciously what we're saying to the client is you can't be trusted with this. Somehow we need to maintain this little bit of secret knowledge, and it maintains our position as the one with the authority, which maintains the relationship of dependency that I talked about earlier. So I found that I had to basically surrender this right as a practitioner, and I give all clients, and I have done for many years, the right not only to know but to fully participate in that knowledge. In other words, if they want to go and read about what it is I'm giving, I'll suggest some reading for them. I'll say, well, you might find it interesting in Catherine Coulter. What does she have to say about that? See if there's something in there that you can relate to, or, you know, another author. So, and that I found has only positive benefits. And the clients really enjoy that. And the ones who don't want to know, then either they tell me they don't want to know, or I might tell them the remedy and it just goes straight over their head. They're really not interested. They say, all right, fine, yeah, whatever, which is okay too, but at least that's their decision. It's not me withholding. So I think absolutely we should be telling clients what remedy we're prescribing, and we should be telling them why. You know, this is these are the reasons I'm giving you this one. This is the area that I'm hoping it's going to help you in. It gives them at least an opportunity to participate consciously in their own healing process.
Yeah, Ian, I really love what you're saying here. I mean, just the idea of engaging the patient in the process as a participatory one. I think it's just a lovely model for us to consider when we're practicing. So, yeah, thank you very much for this. Now, sometimes, you know, we do have clients who are uncooperative or defensive or otherwise, you know, unpleasant to be around. Any suggestions or ideas on how we can best deal with these types of patients?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the great thing with homeopathy is that everything, even obnoxious behavior, is a symptom, can be viewed as a symptom, an outer expression of an inner disturbance.
Sure.
So we've got rubrics for all these things, you know, anger when questioned, or tendency to contradict, or repulsive mood, or whatever it is.
Sure.
The problem, of course, is that we're human beings before we're homeopaths. So we can't always avoid getting hooked or triggered, I call it, by our clients' behaviors and attitudes. And when we do get hooked, what I've noticed is, certainly for myself, I cease to be an effective healer at that moment. That something in me has become hooked by something a client said, or even something they didn't say, because then I'm into a reactive mode. You know, when something in me gets triggered, I have a certain emotional response to that client for whatever reason. If I don't acknowledge that and own it as my own, then I will be in a reactive mode. So I myself will start getting defensive, or even aggressive, or all those things that are, you know, it could be classed as difficult. And I'm no longer really effective as a healer, I think, as soon as that's happened. So I think, what do we do about it? Well, first we have to recognize that this phenomenon is not a random occurrence. You know, it's not everybody that comes in that gets our heckles up. It's every now and again, it's a certain type of person. Or it's a person that comes in with a certain category of ailment, and suddenly we go into panic mode. You know, they mention cancer or something, and we go, And we carry on pretending that we're okay with it, but inside, now I've got a knot in my stomach. You know, somehow this one got to me. Something they said has touched something in me. So what that tells me is that there's a susceptibility issue here, namely that we're only affected by those clients who are touching on something that was there in the first place, in us, which we weren't aware of. And the starting point for being able to overcome this problem is to acknowledge that, say a quiet thank you for bringing it to our attention. The second thing is we need to be willing to take responsibility for our own reactions, so that we resist the urge to project it onto them, you know, rather than labeling them as a difficult client and so forth, or so they're being resistant to getting well. This kind of idea, this is usually a projection on the part of the practitioner. I learned a lot from Milton Erickson, who's one of the great hypnotherapists of the last century. There's a whole branch of hypnotherapy called Ericksonian hypnotherapy. And a lot of the work now, which goes under the heading of NLP, was developed from his work. And he was a master at seeing behaviors which most people would see as just difficult or downright resistant or obnoxious. He would invariably be able to see it as something useful or serving a useful function in that person's life, or at least it did do, and then they just got stuck in that mode. In other words, trying to see that this person's defensive for a good reason. Maybe there's a real vulnerability there that they feel the need to protect. And, you know, just having that understanding, that ability to go beyond what's been presented and get an insight into what's behind it, this can be a great help. But I think we also, as practitioners, we need to be willing to investigate our own reactions. If we get triggered by someone, we should be able and willing to take that to, if necessary, to a third party, to our own practitioner, and work with it, you know, and bring it into consciousness. such that when we can be then work through it, and we can be able to work with that client in a healthier mode. I think that finally, we have to recognize we can't really help anyone until we can accept them as they are. You know, that's really the cornerstone of all healing work. It's rooted in a compassion which can accept whatever comes. How do we get to that place? It's an ongoing project. You know, a lot of it for me has been, you might put it in the category, Jung's terminology, shadow work, bringing into conscious awareness what was lying dormant in our own psyche. This is really what it's about. If I'm getting triggered by somebody, then it's something in me that's being triggered, and I should take responsibility for that.
You know, it does happen sometimes during the course of our practice that we have these days from hell where, you know, we've got, 10 Hayao Siam's follow-ups and Barash from album follow-ups. And, you know, is there a way to protect ourselves from, you know, these types of days where we're just, be constantly being exposed to some pretty intense energies?
Yeah, I've gone through, I've revised my own position on this idea of protecting ourselves over the years. I mean, I think many practitioners, certainly in the early part of their practice life, they have a kind of almost ritualistic behavior around how they set up their clinic and their practice space. You know, you do some incense, and I know practitioners have crystals in the room and all this kind of stuff. And there's this idea that you need to somehow create a vibration which is going to protect you. That's all well and good up to a point, but it invariably breaks down under certain circumstances. As you say, you can still have a bummer of a day when all of that goes out the window. Ultimately, I think it's neither possible nor necessary, except in as much as when that person's issues coincide with my own. So I go back to that. It's a susceptibility thing again. If a client comes in and I go home feeling angry and frustrated, I think the real key to working with that is to recognize that's my anger and frustration that I'm feeling. They didn't give it to me. I think this is a real misperception to believe that somehow you've picked up their feelings. I know many healers and homeopaths have sworn to me that that's what happened, but when I worked with them, it's invariably been discovered that that wasn't what happened at all. What happened was that the client revealed it to them. You know, they were the catalyst that brought it into awareness, but they didn't give it. The person cannot give you a feeling, a state that you didn't already have. They can trigger it and catalyze it, but that's about the end of it. So really, the way to protect yourself, if that's the right terminology to use, is to own your own feelings and your own unresolved issues. Take responsibility for working through them in a safe environment, such that they're not like these kind of raw nerves just waiting to be trodden on. So I think it goes back to, for me, the necessity for practitioners to be committed to their own self-healing journey on an ongoing basis. It's not to say that you have to be completely healed yourself before you can help anyone else. Of course not. But at least have that commitment to working on and working through your own stuff as and when it comes up in an ongoing sense.
I like it. One of the things that a lot of people notice, and I certainly have noticed this with my own situation, is that it's very difficult to treat relatives and sometimes close friends. I've seen this especially with relatives, like, you know, your wife or your child. And oftentimes you're doing really well with, you know, your regular practice, but you're just not getting the same results with those who are, you know, close around you. Do you have any comments on that situation, or have you experienced that at all? Or?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Of course. You know, why is it so difficult to treat our loved ones? Well, I've come to the conclusion it's because we love them. And as a result, we care too much. Mm-hmm. We've got too much investment in the outcome to be able to act in an appropriate manner. There's a little poem from the, I think it's the Taoist tradition, which I've always been fond of quoting. It's called The Need to Win, because when an archer is shooting for nothing, he has all his skill. If he shoots for a brass buckle, he's already nervous. If he shoots for a prize of gold, he goes blind or sees two targets. He's out of his mind. His skill has not changed, but the prize divides him. He cares, thinking more of winning than of shooting, and the need to win drains him of power. Now, I think that's true in any setting. It's not just about archery. In homeopathy, when we care too much about getting it right or the person getting well, then that investment clouds our judgment. It becomes impossible for us to see the wood for the trees, so to speak. And, you know, you can send that same person, I mean, as I did with one of my own parents who I'd unsuccessfully tried to treat for a long time, sent her to a friend and colleague who was less experienced than myself, but immediately saw what was needed. And as soon as she told it to me, I said, well, of course, it was obvious to me as well, but I couldn't see it. And I think the other thing that gets in the way is that it's very hard for us to allow our loved ones to suffer. We're affected by that. I think it was Thomas Keane who said, one of the hardest things I've had to learn is to allow my nearest and dearest to have their own suffering. You know, just to have it, just to let them suffer and to find their own healing process. Obviously, we can support them as best we can, but we can't take it away from them. And often that's the unconscious impulse when someone close to us, you know, your own child, your own mother, your own partner, when they're suffering, we want to make it okay for them. But that very desire to make it okay somehow gets in the way of our ability to do so. So I always recommend a referral for one's loved ones these days. Unless, I mean, the exception for me is a simple thing like a first aid or a simple acute where it's blaringly obvious. You know, if my daughter falls over, bangs her head, of course I give her arnica. I don't send her to somebody else. But beyond that, you know, the constitutional level, particularly chronic disease prescribing, I can't do it for my loved ones. I don't attempt to do so.
Well, you know, we're kind of running short on time here, but I did want to, you know, you obviously have a very broad understanding of many different modalities of healing and energy work, and I just thought maybe you could just end by just kind of letting us know what are your most major influences. So we kind of have, and I'm hoping that maybe in the future, because I know this was kind of very brief, just introductory interview, but I'm hoping that maybe in the future you'll come back and cover one of these subjects in more depth so we can talk about that later. But I was just curious, in general, what have been some of your most profound influences in the healing work that you're doing today?
Okay. Certainly, I've mentioned some of them already, in the psychology field, people like Carl Jung has been a big influence. Not that I ever met him, but just through his writings and people that have interpreted his work. I think, you know, he was one of the giants of the last century, and we're only just starting to get to grips with some of the things that he postulated. Also Fritz Perls, Gestalt founder, R.D. Lang, we've already mentioned, in that area. Stanislav Grof is another in the...
Oh, Stanislav Grof, huh?
Yeah.
Problems of the human unconscious.
That's right.
Yeah.
Arnold Mindell,
yeah.
You know, these guys, mostly from your own country, I have to say.
Sure.
I think, you know, they're taking forward this sort of consciousness movement in leaps and bounds. And I think it's really helpful for us as homeopaths to at least keep aware of, you know, the major understandings that have been developed in these fields by these guys. Also, I mentioned Milton Erickson in the context of hypnotherapy. He was just a genius healer and someone who can do the kind of magic healing work as he did. I don't care what therapy they practice, you know. I want to know something about how they're working, just because it was something about that personality himself who... You know, it was so original, and one of the things that he taught me was the best healer really is the one who's just fully himself or herself, where you really connect with your own center, you might say, and you work from that place. Then what you'll do will often appear to contradict the standard rules of your profession, as those are true in his case, and yet your results will still be very, very good and often better than other people's. But I also learned a lot from... you mentioned the flower essence field and the herbal medicine field. I felt very lucky to have been exposed to this before I got into homeopathy, because it stayed with me. A lot of homeopaths I've met have prejudice against herbal or flower essences. They think they're kind of inferior modes of healing compared to homeopathy. They seem relatively simplistic. But I think it's all to do with where you approach them from. And the herbal tradition goes way, way back. You know, it's much, much older than the homeopathic tradition. And there's something about that reminding me of the connection to nature that I've learned from the herbalists. Again, to quote a contemporary, your own Matthew Wood, I think he's a fantastic...
wonderful writer.
Yeah, who homeopaths, I mean, he's also a homeopath in his own right, as well as a herbalist, and I think he crosses the divide beautifully. And I've learned such a great deal from about working with clients from him. People like Edward Bartsch in the flower essence field, Arthur Bailey, Ian White. This is a field that's still being developed passionately by people since Edward Bartsch's death, and the flower essences have really opened up areas for me. Things like working in the area of unconscious beliefs, that's an area where you can really struggle as a homeopath. The person has a belief that they're incurable or something like that. How do you work with that? It's not always adequate just to prescribe a remedy that matches that in the repertory. So I also, again, learning from people like Erickson and Lang, but sometimes you need to be able to completely bypass what the symptom picture is presenting and read the energy directly, like we talked about earlier. So this field is huge in its own right, but I studied a therapy called Shen therapy, which is quite a simple model of getting to grips with the energy body. I've got friends who've done, for example, polarity therapy, or craniosacral therapy, which again, it gives you a fairly simple but quite adequate working knowledge of the energy system, which I think enhances anybody's homeopathic work. I mean, look at great homeopaths like Jeremy Scher, for example. How does he interpret his casework? Well, it's directly influenced from his training in Chinese medicine. And he says so, and without that, you will not be able to arrive at some of the insights that practitioners like that can arrive at. It's that extra dimension of being able to read the energy system that I've just picked up here and there from working with Chinese medicine practitioners, studying the chakra system, to the extent that I got a working knowledge of that, like a kind of map of the energy field, so that a person comes in and treating symptomatically based on the symptoms doesn't seem to be doing something well. What would happen if I read the energy here? How does that, what does that insight does that give me? And it opens up the case in a whole different way.
Fascinating. Okay, well, I think I'll go ahead and invite the participation of some of the other people who have joined us for the call. Before I do that, though, for those of you who joined us late, let me just say that we are offering a special on Ian Watson's materials, both his CD set. There's quite an extensive number of CDs on various subjects, and those are all discounted, as are his titles. And if you buy one item, you get a 10% discount. If you buy two items, it's 15%. And if you buy three or more items, Allison, correct me if I'm wrong with any of this, it's a 20% discount.
Yeah, and that's, one item on your order is, if one item's Ian's, you get 10% off your whole order. So this is a great time to do your pre-Christmas.
Oh, very good. Okay, and you can go to Whole Health Now, WHOLE Health, HEALTHNOW, Whole Health Now. .com/books, or you can call them toll free at 866-599-5950. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead now and unmute the line, and we'll welcome some other questions.
I'm wondering if...
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi.
You're wondering?
This is Sue from Ontario.
Hey, Sue.
Hi, Sue.
Hi. I'm wondering if you're aware of or familiar with the work of Ken Wilber at the Integral Institute in Boulder, Colorado.
Yes, I am.
Awesome. We're sending our daughter down there for some training in April, and I was interested in contacting him about his integral medical approach, which you mentioned on your call today, in that the practitioner in integral medicine is also being treated in the course. Have you had conversations with him?
No, I haven't. No, I'm only familiar with him through his writings and other people that have been influenced by him. But his work is also voluminous, is it not? It probably rivals Carl Jung's, I think, by now. But I've only scratched the surface of really what he's doing. But I think anybody who works in this field for a length of time tends to arrive at a similar place, and there is this recognition of the need to integrate, as you say, to not to stay narrowly caught in the bounds of your own profession or discipline, but at least to have an awareness of some of the things that are going on in other fields, because they can really positively influence the work you're doing. Not that you have to train in all those things. I'm not encouraging people to be a jack of all trades, but just having that awareness sometimes is very helpful.
Great, thank you.
Another question?
I have a question. I was wondering, when you have clients who, you know, you tell them what their remedy is, and then they search on the internet and they find all this, you know, kind of weird information sometimes, and then they come back and say, hey, you know, I'm not like this. Why did you give me this? You know, said this and that. How do you deal with that? Because I'm at the point of just about, you know, not telling the patients exactly what the remedy is for that reason, because there's so much junk on the internet.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a good question. For a start, if it's someone who doesn't really know much about homeopathy, you can at least forewarn them. You know, that's something I've done in an interview many times. I'll show them Materia Medica and I'll say, look, you know, these remedy pictures are compilations from hundreds of people. You know, this is not from one person. This is from dozens of provers and hundreds of people in clinical practice. So there's going to be many, many things in this picture which don't match you, but there are a few things which match you very well. These are the reasons that it's been prescribed. So you help the person to understand that it's always a selective thing. Because I think the mistake that we make as beginners is we look at all these things in the picture and say, that's not me, that's not me. And it isn't. You know, they're right, oftentimes. So, you know, the first thing I do is I agree with them. I say, well, of course not. You know, there's going to be most of the remedy picture will not be you. The important thing is that we match what is troubling you to something similar in a remedy, that's all. And the main part of our job with homeopaths is to leave out, you know, what doesn't match. So I just, you know, I try and educate people. That's the way homeopathy works. And, of course, they're going to find all kinds of weird and wonderful things. What I do is I preempt it by showing them something really weird, you know. So anything they can come up with isn't as bad, you know. I say, look, you should read a few of these delusions, you know. Look at this. Of course you haven't got these, but this is also the kind of thing this remedy can be used for. You can sort of take the sting out of it that way.
Any special tips about Metarhinum or Cephalinum, Ian?
Yeah. I think the main tip is like, don't treat them like they're that much different to anything else.
Uh-huh.
You know, we use all kinds of obnoxious substances, you know. Why is gonorrhea worse than arsenic, for goodness sake? It's only in the mind of the practitioner. I think the more we try and hide things because we think that, you know, patients really ought not, you know, would be better not knowing, it's almost like the more guaranteed they are to find out. It's, you know, it's like Bluebeard, the one hidden thing.
Yeah.
When we hide something, even if we don't tell them that it's hidden, or if we think we have good reasons, something in them unconsciously will pick that up, and there'll be a need to know will start to develop. So I watch that tendency within myself to make certain remedies special, or, you know, to have these special cases. If I'm giving a nosode, I tell a person it's a nosode, and I explain to them what nosodes are, and they're okay with that. This is the real crucial thing, is to recognize when you're okay with it, so are they. When you've got a problem with it, they'll reflect it back to you that you have a problem with it. And that's your problem.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome.
Ian, how much work do you do with chakras these days, or in your clinic?
Well, not a great deal, at least consciously. You know, it was something that I studied for a good few years, and when you're studying something, you're getting familiar with it, then it's informing your work daily because you're constantly updating your kind of map of the terrain. Then you get to a certain point where you consign it to the unconscious because you don't need to think that way anymore. It's something that just comes in automatically when the need is there. So that's more the relationship I have to it now. And it's the same with the things I learned from Chinese medicine. you know, I don't automatically go through thinking, well, okay, what's this chakra doing? What's that chakra doing? But I might simply notice, well, where's this person's energy tied up? You know, in a very general sense, where's the energy blocked in their system? If I look at this person as a whole, some people, it's all in the throat. I can see it, you know, from the way they talk, the way they hold their body, the way they grasp at their collar every few moments. I say, okay, the energy is all pointing to the throat here. Then, once you've seen that, just from the body language and the gestures and so forth, having the knowledge then of the chakras opens up a whole field of information for you. You say, okay, what do I know about throat chakra? Well, it's to do with communication, of course. It's also to do with creativity. It's got a very strong connection with the sacral chakra number two, to do with sexuality. So there could be a link here. And I might, it could open up a whole line of questioning for me, just having that sitting in the background. Then again, you know, if the remedy is clear and obvious, why bother? You know, I don't use something just because I've learnt about it. It's, for me, it's a tool to bring in when you need something else to make sense of the case. If the case is clear, pulsatilla, I just give pulsatilla. Don't worry about it.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question.
Then can you say a word or two about homeopathy and the planets?
And the planets? Yeah. This is an idea that I first came across by reading Paracelsus, who I think most scholars though agree that Hahnemann definitely read Paracelsus. He took the trouble to slag Paracelsus off in the Organon, but we can also conclude that he actually learned a lot from him. Paracelsus was a 15th century alchemist who said that no physician can really claim to be a good physician who is not first an astrologer. And in those days, there were not the false divisions between the sciences and the arts as there are now. And there was a recognition of the correspondences, as they were called, between the heavenly and the earthly realm. So the organs and systems of the bodies were seen to be our inner cosmos, our inner solar system. The sun, of course, being the heart, and so on and so forth. Jupiter is our liver, and et cetera, et cetera. This was, my interest in this was rekindled by Robin Murphy. It's a field that he got into as well through his own studies, and took it a lot further than I ever did. But it became another possible, really it's a diagnostic map which can be useful in certain cases where the normal ways of working are not really opening up the case for you. It's kind of coming in from left field somewhere, and you don't need to even draw up a person's natal chart or anything. I'm not a professional astrologer, nothing like it, but just by using day of birth, date of birth, and their current age. Part of the system that I learned through Robin Murphy relates to the cycles and seasons of a person's life. And again, this has been reinforced by the studies I've made of Carl Jung, and also is emphasized by Rudolf Steiner and others, is that there are certain transitions that we all go through in life as human beings, not identically at the same age, but there are natural cycles and progressions. And the problems of the 20-year-old are not the same as the problems of the 40-year-old. And, you know, a person who comes in age 40 will often think that they have something unique. And, in fact, if you study the bigger picture, you quickly recognize, oh, no, you've got the problem of the 42-year-old, you know, join the club. So I found that studying the planets in this way, recognizing that there are these cyclical influences, I'm not saying it's the planets that do it to us. For me, it's just a system of correspondences. You could use the tarot in the same way. You know, it's another map, if you like. But it can be a useful map. And if you've got an interest in the planets, then, you know, I recommend studying it. Some people are really passionate about that.
Wonderful. Many, many thanks, Ian.
You're welcome.
Kim, have we lost everybody?
Can you hear me?
Hello.
Hello.
Have we lost everybody?
No.
I'm here.
Still here.
I'm here.
It sounds like Kim has disappeared.
Oh.
Do we have any more questions?
Yeah, I would like to make a comment that this has really been very, very good conference for me to hear because I've come into homeopathy with a great deal of medical experience behind me and have studied massage and body work and nursing, and I've had a whole raft of information, which all was useful. And then when I studied homeopathy, I studied with a very, very strict classical homeopathist who's brilliant, but very strict classical homeopathy. And so when we would discuss patient cases, I would bring in sociology, body work, all these other things, and it was like, no, don't do that. You know, that's not it. And so I've always felt kind of like on my left foot with this, and it's really not. I think all of this is so true and applicable and makes so much common sense.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that. I've heard that so many times
from
therapists who said that somehow they thought they had to leave behind, you know, all the skills and knowledge and experience they've gained in other fields because somehow it had to be separated out from the homeopathy. And I've always encouraged people to integrate it, find a way to integrate it.
Right, and I think it's so necessary, but it's nice to have that encouragement to do it.
Yeah.
And not feel like a lunatic or a,
and schizophrenic.
So thanks very much for this.
You're welcome. I think if it helps you to become more integrated in who you are, then that is a key component of helping other people to do the same for themselves, which is what healing is all about, isn't it?
Exactly.
Thanks for your comment. Yes,
I'll
go ahead, please.
I'll just intervene for 1 second. I'm not sure, you know, there will come a time when the system will just end this call, but go ahead.
When you have a client that is pushing your buttons in ways and you become aware of what you're feeling and all, do you share your feelings at all with people?
Yes, absolutely. That's called self-disclosure.
Uh-huh.
And that in itself can be very healing in the interaction.
How does that jive with the whole issue of boundaries and, you know, that the person really isn't your friend?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you,
there's no contradiction there. You can maintain a professional relationship and boundary at the same time as disclosing that you feel uncomfortable at a certain time. I don't see that there's a contradiction there. You're not inviting the person over for dinner or something. You're simply saying, you know what, I feel anxious at the moment because I don't really feel like I'm getting anywhere, you know, or I feel like everything I've tried hasn't worked so far and I wonder how you are with that. You know, I put it out as a kind of invitation for something to discuss. You know, this is how I'm feeling, how are you with that? I'm not sort of hoping they'll do therapy on me or, you know, dumping my feelings on them. It's usually something that I bring in when I'm genuinely struggling. And I find that it generally opens something up in the case. Just that willingness to expose something of yourself, it's like you let this sort of mask come down a little bit and you say, you know what, I'm struggling too. And they see you're a human being. People generally respond to that positively. It's not necessarily problematic. You can keep all the other boundaries are still in place. Your ethical boundaries are still in place and so forth. So it's something that you work with and you develop over time. And you also may need to keep some things for your own therapy work. You know, there are things that it might be better not to share. Supposing you find a client really attractive. That might happen. Well, it might not be appropriate to share that with them. You might be better off sharing that with a third party and working through that in your own time. So there is a need for discrimination too.
Great. Well, Kim, have we got you back? No, it looks like Kim has gone.
Kim's gone, but we're all still here.
But we're still here. But I don't know if they can, I don't think we can hear anybody. I think it got toggled out again.
Okay.
So usually at this point, we have an opportunity to untoggle and let everybody say goodbye, but I think Kim, who's had his finger on the switch, has been dropped from the call.
Can you hear me, guys?
Oh, there he is. He's back.
Oh, sorry. I don't know. My phone went dead for some reason.
Hi, Kim.
Well,
we thought we'd lost you there.
No, sorry about that. So,
Kim,
Ian, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us, and it was a wonderful call. I hope you'll come back some point in the near future and join us again.
I'd be happy to do that, yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
Okay, and you have
a
good evening there in Great Britain.
You guys have a great day.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.